My name is Mel Peel, and the title of our session is The Harsh and Dreadful Love of Dorothy Day. And for the last couple of days, I've been talking about Dorothy Day and the Catholic worker movement. And in this session, what I'd like to do is to take up some of Dorothy's particular dimensions, her many facets, her different outlooks on things, say a little bit about those myself, but what I'm going to rely on especially in this session is reading some of her own writing. I don't know how many of you have ever come across her writing, either in small portions or in larger portions, but I think that she is really a very marvelous writer, and much of what can be learned from her about her comes from some of her works. So what I'm going to do is describe a few of what I seem to be important themes in her life and emphases that she carried on, perhaps tell a few little anecdotes about her that are sort of famous or infamous in the Catholic worker circles and insofar as that's rippled out to a larger, wider public. And hopefully, perhaps, somewhere in those writings, I think if you find them at least as interesting as I do, maybe we can have some conversation about the kind of outlook that lies behind her writing, and maybe have some sense of why at least she's had some influence. For those of you who don't know anything about her at all, I could just provide a brief introduction to say that she was an American journalist who was born just before the turn of the century, who converted to Catholicism after a sort of radical and bohemian youth in New York's Greenwich Village. She converted in 1927, and in 1933, along with an itinerant French philosopher, peasant named Peter Morin, she founded the Catholic Worker Movement, which established a series of houses of hospitality, they called them, in the inner cities of initially New York and then many other places around the country. Dorothy Day resided in those houses of hospitality throughout the rest of her life. She became a very well-known public activist, published a newspaper called The Catholic Worker that developed a very wide circulation and reading. She died in 1980, but the Catholic Worker movement still continues. There are somewhere, I don't know the precise figures, between 80 and 100 Catholic Worker houses still operating, and her influence is considerable. Although perhaps she's not as widely known as some other people might be. But I might just mention that one historian, David O'Brien, who's a leading historian of American Catholicism, has said that Dorothy Day was the most significant, influential, and interesting person in the history of American Catholicism, which was really quite a remarkable statement. That was the obituary that appeared in Commonweal magazine. Quite a remarkable statement, considering that she was a lay person, she never held any office, she never sought any kind of office, she had no status, a formal status whatsoever, and for most of her career, in fact, she was considered a very marginal, if not dangerous, sort of figure. So to have that kind of a tribute was quite remarkable. Well, let me say a little bit about some of Dorothy's primary concerns and the many dimensions of this character. And obviously, you can't completely capture a whole person's life and character and interest in a brief period, especially someone as very complex as Dorothy Day was. She was an extraordinarily complex personality as well as an influential writer and activist. But I think the place to start, and the place where she would certainly start in any kind of account of her public life and even her personal outlook on things, is with her interest in poverty and the poor and the works of mercy and bringing the Christian vision to the needy sort of world. And the quote I chose, or the quote that she often used, comes from Dostoevsky, who was one of her real favorites. She was always a great reader of novels and literature, particularly Russian literature, and particularly Dostoevsky. And the actual quote is, love in action is different from love in dreams. The quotation goes on from Dostoevsky in greater length, but the essence of it is that in our dreams, in our visions, in our self-understandings of what we should be, love is always just a wonderful thing. and we're always sort of heroes of love, we're always heroes of selflessness, we're always doing good for others, and so on, and it's quite a nice thing to be involved with. But in fact, if we actually attempt to live out the kind of love that we profess, it becomes a quite different matter altogether, and it becomes a very difficult kind of challenge, a kind of discipline. It requires a kind of struggle and insight that's by no means easy to realize. So what I thought I might do then is read a couple of the quotations in Dorothy's own work, particularly with the poor. And I should say, the Catholic Worker Houses of Hospitality, where she lived, worked with the poorest of the poor, usually those who were really down and out, on the very bottom, skid row, people who were very, very in very, very poor circumstances, and often had to struggle with those kind of difficulties. So let me just read a couple of little passages where you will, I think, both see her account of what circumstances are like where she is. She always wrote very directly about what those circumstances were, but also some of the perceptions and reactions about that. Here she is, this is in 1934, not long after the newspaper started, writing about both the public municipal lodging houses for the poor and also some of her own perceptions. One afternoon last month, we went up to the municipal lodging house of the city of New York and looked at the largest bedroom in the world there. The 17 beds in a row, the 8 rows stretching way out to the very end of a pier, 2-tiered beds at that, were a grim sight, the collectivization of misery. The huge vats of stew stirred with a tremendous ladle only emphasized the ugly state which the world is in today. Every night the men stand out on 25th Street in long lines and are hustled through, cataloged, ticketed, stamped with the seal of approval, fed in a rush and passed on to the baths, the doctors, the beds, all with a grim efficiency which gave testimony to the length of time this need has existed for the massed care of the impoverished. The attendant who showed us around told us of how the lame, the halt, and the blind were being housed at the Muni, were transported in a bus to a place which the Salvation Army runs for such men, where they can sit inside all day out of the wind and rain. But what about Catholic provision for such men? There is none. Oh, for parish houses of hospitality. If the largest bedroom in the world was a sad sight, the women's dormitory was even sadder. At one end of it, there were beds with little cribs by the side of them for women and babies. But women know that if they are forced to accept the hospitality of the city, their older children will be taken away and only infants left to them, so not many of them go there. Our escort told us a family which had come in the night before. The family had been evicted, and the mother was so sick she had to be carted off to the hospital, and the man, the old grandmother, and the 3 children had to go to the city for relief. The older grandchildren were taken to the children's aid, and the baby left with the grandmother. And what must have been the thoughts of that mother lying in the hospital, wondering where her mother, her children, and her husband were spending the night? What but thoughts of hatred and despair that such cruelty and inhumanity can exist today? Well, that is Dorothy Day as a protest writer, I would say. And here is another one. This is from an excerpt from one of her appeals for funds for the Catholic Worker, and she says, God seems to intend us to solely depend on Him. We mislive this lesson of dependence on Him that we preach in these pages. Economic security, something every reader and we ourselves would like to have, is not for us. We must live by faith from day to day, knowing that we have good friends in St. Joseph, St. Teresa, St. John Bosco, who lived through these same struggles themselves. What security did the Blessed Virgin have as she fled in the night with the baby in her arms to go into a strange country? She probably wondered whether St. Joseph would be able to obtain work in a foreign land, how they would get along, and anticipated the loneliness of being without her friends, her cousin, St. Elizabeth, her other kinfolk. We accept by faith the mystery of the Trinity. We accept by faith the Holy Eucharist. When Christ says, "This is my body," we as Catholics believe. We believe many a hard saying, so why not believe those words, "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and his justice, and all these things shall be added unto you." Well, one more thing I might mention, since so much of her life and work in the houses of hospitality had this very grim quality, and they were always in desperate circumstances in terms of attempting to deal with the immense needs that they encountered there. It's really quite remarkable that Dorothy could always sort of find sources of either joy or some kind of pleasure in those kind of settings. And she always struggled very much to make sure that the other side of the story always came through so that it didn't simply become a chronicle of desperation and misery. And this in two straight paragraphs in an article written in 1937, give this sense, I think. She says, "As I sit, I am weeping. I have been torn recently by people, by things that happen. Surely we are, here in our community, made up of poor lost ones, the abandoned ones, the sick, the crazed, and the solitary human beings whom Christ so loved, and in whom I see, with a terrible anguish, the body of this death. And out in the streets, wandering somewhere, is Mr. Minus, solitary among a multitude, surrounded all day long, but not one of us save in his humanity, denying, not knowing, yet clinging to some dream, some ideal of beauty, which he tries to express in the poetry which no one but he can read." Then the next paragraph is, "Franciscan spirit grows hereabout. Last night, Mr. Minus, who is devoted to our black cat, was discovered washing her chest with my wash rag and drying her with my towel and then anointing her with a warming oil for a bad cough. It's good I discovered him in the act. Then Big Dan, our chief of staff on the streets of New York, who sells the paper every day on 14th Street or in front of Macy's, took one of my blankets to cover the old horse which helps us deliver our Manhattan bundles of papers every month. He's truly a Catholic worker horse, Dad says, and when they go up Fifth Avenue and pass St. Patrick's Cathedral, the horse genuflects. Dan delivers the papers all over New York every month when the new issue comes out, and throughout the month he sells. He likes to stand next to the communists who sell the Daily Worker, and as the latter shout, 'Read the Daily Worker,' Dan shouts, 'Read the Catholic Worker daily.'" He also shouts out, "Catholic Worker romance on every page." And some of the communists who would come up would yell at him, cursing the cardinal, why he gets drunk every Saturday night with his housekeeper. And Dan always replies, "And doesn't that just show how democratic he is?" She loved to store up these kind of anecdotes and report them as part of the way of life in the Catholic Worker. Another dimension of Dorothy Day, I think, that's very important to understand is that she really was a leader, very charismatic kind of person. I only met her once, but that was obviously in her older days. But even then, she had a tremendous personal presence, and she was one of those people whom everyone said that when she walked into the room, you paid attention. And even in her early pre-conversion days, people had always been attracted to her as a very compelling sort of personality. She had a sort of dramatic flair about her all the time that commanded attention. And always people were looking to her for leadership and looking to her for direction. And of course, as this movement took on, at least particularly in the 1930s, initially lots of people got involved and so on, the whole question of leadership and how to direct things became a real challenge for her. She was very strong-willed. She was not a shrinking violet at all. She had to be very tough and very strong to carry on this kind of enterprise under these sort of conditions. But at the same time, as I suppose any leader experiences, there are all kinds of difficult pressures and challenges in this kind of circumstance. And how do you do that and maintain your integrity and the integrity of your movement? So Dorothy Day as leader, I think, is another important theme. And let me just read a couple of passages on that, although some of these also bear on the same kind of themes I was talking about before, I think. She says, and this is more from one of her diaries that was later reprinted. She says, "Low in mind all day, full of tears. What with Easton, New York, Boston, Ottawa, Toronto, and St. Louis groups, all discouraged, all looking for organization instead of self-organization, all of them weary of the idea of freedom and personal responsibility. I feel bitterly oppressed, yet confirmed in the conviction that we have to emphasize personal responsibility at all costs, is most certainly at the price of bitter suffering for myself, for I am just in the position of a dictator trying to legislate herself out of existence. They accept my regime, which emphasizes freedom and personal responsibility, but under protest. They all complain at the idea of there being this freedom, that there is no boss. Today I just happened to light on Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, which was most apropos. Freedom, how people hate it and chafe under it, how unhappy they are with it. And just to put a little flesh on that, this is the kind of encounters you had in a group like this, all of whom people were idealists, supposedly committed to this, but living under these circumstances with a great range of folks. In town, the usual crosses. Carney calling us all racketeers, calling the spiritual reading pious twaddle. E with his vile accusations, the misery of M&P. Kate's illness, the threatened suit against us, the bills piling up. These things to be topped by such a lack of understanding of the personalist idea from those whom you expect the most lays me low. Since I got back from Pittsburgh, I've had this completely alone feeling, a temptation of the devil, doubtless, and to succumb to it is a lack of faith and hope. There's nothing to do but bear it, but my heart is as heavy as lead, and my mind is dull and uninspired. A time when the memory and understanding fail one completely, and only the will remains, so that I feel hard and rigid, and at the same time ready to sit like a soft fool and weep. So that obviously a moment of real discouragement there, and that was in the summer of 1936. But then this comes a little later on, and she says, the trees are getting bare. This is in November of that same year. The trees are getting bare, but still it stays warm. Coming down at night from the city, the warm, sweet smell of the good earth enwraps one like a garment. There's the smell of rotting apples or alfalfa in the barn, burning leaves, of wood fires in the house, of pickled green tomatoes and baked beans. During that summer, when things were going especially hard in more ways than one, I grimly modified the grace before our meals. Quote, we give thee thanks, O Lord, for these thy gifts and for all our tribulations from thy bounty through Christ our Lord. Amen. One could know of certain knowledge that tribulations were matters of thanksgiving, that we were indeed privileged to share in the suffering of our Lord. So in this month of thanksgiving, we can be thankful for the trials of the past, the blessing of the present, and be heartily ready at the same time to embrace with joy any troubles the future may bring us. So there, she's sort of broken through at least that particular crisis in the leadership and willing to carry on the struggle as well as she could. I might say a little bit more about her as a leader. She was, in fact, really a very highly cultivated person who liked opera and music and so on. So this experience of constantly living under very harsh conditions was often quite difficult for her. And at times she would, since she was a very strong-willed woman, she would sort of explode in anger, and some of the stories that are told is that every so often in these houses, which were usually in the slums and very noisy and people be playing radios and things like this, that Dorothy Day would burst out into the hallways and yell, "Holy silence!" And then everything would quiet down for a half hour or so. It's also said that she was no shrinking violet whatsoever. She had a very strong temper, and people were always telling her that she should hold your temper. And she is reported to reply, I hold more temper in 1 minute than you will in your entire life. So she was not necessarily an easy person to get along with, and she had to have that kind of strength of will in order to be able to carry out, I think, the sort of work of mercy and love that she did. One of her closest associates said about her, as a character description of her, she's tough, she's smart, she doesn't listen well all the time, and she holds grudges. This is not an easy person you're talking about if you live with her, but also someone who could work through all those things and feel her own sense of failing all the time and constantly getting up and starting back over. Another dimension of her life that I think I might just describe very briefly and perhaps read a passage or two, is her very great emphasis on her role as mother and her role in family life. Often I tend to think that people who become involved in public sorts of concerns or political activism or whatever sort of begin to separate those two dimensions of existence. And they have a public existence in one place and their private existence in another, and perhaps that's very necessary. But in the case of Dorothy Day, since she had a child, but then the child's father left at the time of her conversion, she raised the child in the context of the Catholic worker movement. And she always had a very great emphasis upon her own role as mother and linked her function as a nurturing parent, I think, to the larger context of the Catholic worker movement, serving people, the whole role of providing food and beds and clothing for people in need seemed to fit right in with this role of being a mother and being a woman. And there's a good deal of emphasis in the movement in that regard, which makes it, I think, often quite different from a lot of the other sorts of social or political movements, even religiously inspired ones that you might encounter. And so let me just read. Again, in her writing, she had a very nice way of linking this perceptions of these kinds of things in both with her social propaganda, but also with, I think, some clever writing techniques. This is one where she was describing the children at the House of the Hospitality, and she says, "The children of the house were bending engrossed over a toy catalog the other day, figuring up what they would like to have for Christmas. 'It's no use looking at it,' one of them was saying. 'It's only for rich children, this catalog. A toy train costs $15. You can tell this is 1935. "When I grow up, I'm going to be rich," 5-year-old Freddie said. "Rich," said 7-year-old Teresa. "Don't you know it's bourgeois to be rich?" I would have liked to tell her that it's also bourgeois to have the acquisitive spirit and to want so much for Christmas, but I didn't have the heart, so I sat down with them to look at the catalog. So through that kind of little twists and turns, I think she conveyed her sense of her own role as a mother. And here's another passage. This is describing her own relations with her daughter. And there are lots of, you know, her writing, there was lots of this kind of thing where she would talk about her family life and then later on visiting her grandchildren and great-grandchildren even. She says, "When my daughter was born almost 18 years ago, I turned her over to the Blessed Mother. What kind of mother am I going to be, I kept thinking to myself. What kind of Catholic home is she going to have with only me? And with the Catholic worker movement starting 6 years later, the home problem was even more acute. There was a solution, of course, to such a difficulty. You, I told the Blessed Mother, will have to be her mother. Under the best of circumstances, I'm a failure as a homemaker. I'm untidy, inconsistent, undisciplined, temperamental, and I have to pray every day for final perseverance. It's only these last few years that it has occurred to me, though, why my daughter has never called me mother. From the time she first spoke, she always called me Dorothy. I'd think, well, with no other children around calling me mother, it is natural for her to call me by my first name. I'd correct her, but it did no good. Later on, I'd ask her, 'How will anyone know if I'm your mother if you do not call me mother? They'll think I adopted you.' 'I don't care,' she would say firmly. 'I just can't call you mother.' And for a child who was really extremely obedient, it was hard to understand such stubbornness. When she was in convent school, her brief letters began, 'Dear Mother,' but it was under compulsion. The sisters would not let her write unless she so began. But after school, away from school, the letters continued, 'Dear Dorothy.' Then a few years ago, it came like a flash of light. The Blessed Virgin Mary is mother of my child. No harm can ever come to her with such a mother." So that's the kind of writing about her family and her, and she would write about cooking and life in the kitchen and so on, a very important dimension of her life. And some people who now write about the Catholic worker have noticed the way in which the movement as a whole took on the character of a kind of extended family, and people would bring their children in and participate in it from that kind of from that kind of dimension. I think I should also say, though, that this domestic side of Dorothy Day was not completely separate from and coexisted with her role as a very political public activist, somebody who took stands on sort of the big public issues and was quite capable of writing about those things and becoming actively involved in those things. She always, through the newspaper, of course, the Catholic Worker, publicized various causes, but she would also march in demonstrations, help to organize labor unions. In the 1950s, she was regularly arrested during the drills that they would have in New York City. At that time, they had anti-nuclear drills in which everyone had to take shelter in case of nuclear war, which was a kind of supreme exercise, I suppose, in the wishful thinking that in case of the nuclear bomb, everyone would head into the subways and be saved. And year after year, the Catholic workers there would refuse to take shelter in that regard, and so they'd be regularly arrested. This was a kind of annual event, along with some other folks there, for a number of years until those drills were ended. But she could write very pungently about public questions, and often did. And let me just read a couple of passages in that regard. This one deals with a coal strike. Again, this is in the 1940s, I believe, but gives a little sense of some of her social writing and social protest. She says, "People want to know what this present coal strike is about. It is about shorter hours, for one thing, instead of the 54-hour weeks the men work now. And it's about the welfare fund. Up to this time, there have been no pensions, no recreation, no education, no adequate medical services. The need for such a fund is evidenced by these figures. Every year, some 1,500 miners are killed. Some 60,000 to 70,000 are injured, many of them so badly they are thrown in the scrap heap. When we can read figures like these, when we read of the inhuman suffering of the workers, when we remember the blood that is on our coal, we know what the Holy Father means when he says that the world has lost a sense of sin. Not personal sin, but social sin. When priests do not cry out for the workers, try to share with the workers their poverty, then surely this is what the Holy Father means when he speaks of the devitalization of the church. They are dead branches indeed. All the way to heaven is heaven because Christ said, I am the way. And work should be part of heaven, not part of hell. In the black underground caverns where the miners lose all light of day, month after month, from early fall to late spring, there is a glimpse of everlasting night where no order is and everlasting horror dwelleth. We want to change people, man's work. We want to make people question their work. Is it on the way to heaven or hell?" So that's some of her writing in that regard. And here's another one. This is after the dropping of the atomic bomb in 1945. This betrays, I think, a touch of bitterness and perhaps deep anger, but is also fairly effective, I think. "Mr. Truman was jubilant. President Truman, true man, what a strange name, come to think of it. We refer to Jesus Christ as true God and true man. Truman is a true man of his time in that he was jubilant. He was not a son of God, brother of Christ, brother of the Japanese, jubilating as he did. He went from table to table on the cruiser which was bringing him home from the Big Three conference, telling the great news. Jubilant, the newspaper said. Jubilate Deo, we have killed 118,000 Japanese. That is, we hope we have killed them. The Associated Press on page 1, column 1 of the Herald Tribune says, the effect is hoped for, not known. It is to be hoped they are vaporized, our Japanese brothers, scattered men, women, and babies to the four winds over the seven seas. Perhaps we will breathe their dust into our nostrils, feel them in the fog of New York in our faces, feel them in the rain on the hills of Easton." I think that's social protest writing at its most effective. The last dimension I think I'll mention before we can open it up for some further conversation, and I might say some more about some of Dorothy Day's writing techniques perhaps in the conversation, is that ultimately I think her most effective role was that of someone who was able to bring together, and perhaps you've sensed it already in some of this writing, sort of the spiritual dimensions of life with the very ordinary and the mundane, the capacity to see sort of the divine and the supernatural in the context of the very ordinary and the natural. And some of her writings about spiritual matters, I think, also have this quality of seeing how things that we think of as distinctly religious can also be carried over into all the dimensions of life. And so let me just read a couple of passages that convey this quality, I think, of a spiritual writer as well. This is writing about Jesus and the sacrament. And she says, "I can sit in the presence of the Blessed Sacrament and wrestle for peace in the bitterness of my soul, a bitterness which many throughout the world feel. And I can find many things in Scripture to console me, to change my heart from hatred to love of enemy. Our worst enemies are those of our own household," Jesus said. Picking up the Scriptures at random, as St. Francis used to do, I read about Peter, James, and John, who went up on the Mount of Transfiguration and saw Jesus talking with Moses and Elias, transfigured before their eyes. "A hint of the life to come," Maritain said. Jesus transfigured, he who was the despised of men, no beauty in him, spat upon, beaten, dragged to his cruel death on the way to the cross, a man so much like other men that it took the kiss of a Judas to single him out from the others when the soldiers, so closely allied to the priests, came to take him. Reading this story of the transfiguration, the words stood out, words foolishly babbled about the first building project of the church proposed by Peter.